This is Digital Music Trends 152 on the 2nd of October 2013. This week on the show, a new bill in the US to introduce performance royalties on traditional radio, Sounddrop's new funding round, Beats' new investor, Spotify's Spotlight feature, Songza's partnership with Foursquare, and the significance of the YouTube Music Awards. This week's show is sponsored by media law firm Sheridan's at sheridans.co.uk. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Leonelli and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And DMT is available as an audio and video show on a variety of channels including iTunes, most podcatchers, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, Spreaker, Stitcher and TuneIn Radio. To get in touch with the show, you can tweet us on at DigiMusicTrends or email us on contact@digitalmusictrends.com. And this week I'm super happy to welcome to the show Scott Cohen, founder of the company The Orchard. So hi Scott, and how's it going today?
Good. Everything's going great. Decent weather here in London.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's we're having a pretty mild autumn, which is pretty good. And also joining us on the show is Chris Ruin, author of Freeloading, How Our Insatiable Hunger for Free Content Starves Creativity. So hi, Chris, and great to have you on the show, and great to see you after DC. I think it was last time we saw each other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the World Creators Summit.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Interesting few days.
Yeah, it's great to be here, and yeah, it's 85 degrees. It's going to be 85 degrees here in New York today. So
wow,
pretty excited about that.
That's pretty cool. And first up, I usually like to do a little plug from the guests. So Scott, anything exciting coming up from The Orchard in terms of other features or artists that you're excited about?
You know, we have so many things coming out every day and every week.
I'm sure.
No, I'm just excited about the sheer volume of and great talent that keeps putting stuff out week after week.
Absolutely, that's great. And Chris, on your front, of course, I would recommend the book Freeloading to the listeners to go and check it out on Amazon. Aside from that, anything else that you're excited about or want to talk about?
Well, I mean, yeah, lots of things happening with the book that I'll be announcing soon on social media, but the paperback version of David Byrne's book, How Music Works, just came out, the black cover, and there's a nice couple of paragraphs where he discusses freeloading and me.
That's great.
In that book, and the book's going to come out in the UK in July. Audiobook is coming out imminently. So yeah, things are still popping with that.
That's great. That's awesome. And yeah, I love How Music Works. It was such a great book. So
yeah,
I look forward to seeing the additional bits from the paperback version. And so this week, it's only fitting to start in these times of U.S. government shutdown
Should we blame Chris? Is this your fault?
Maybe.
It's all my fault.
Yeah, it's all your fault.
I'll shoulder all the blame. Yeah.
So I thought it was only fitting to start with by talking about a bill. So a bill that has generated quite a bit of press this week, which was introduced by U.S. Congressman Mel Watt, and it's called the Free Market Royalty Act. So this bill would see to it that radio broadcasters will have to compensate musicians and recording artists for the performance of songs over the air. So these fees, these performance royalties essentially would apply to AM and FM stations, ending the special arrangement that the music industry has had with the radios, which essentially granted them free play as far as the master is concerned of music in exchange for publicity. So this is a very interesting new bill that's been introduced. Of course, the music industry has been trying to push in this direction ever since the days of Frank Sinatra. I think that was the first time that a bill of this kind they tried to pass a bill of this kind. And the interesting thing about the bill as well is that it won't impose a particular license fee or a compulsory license fee like for most other performance royalties that are out there, but it will be something that is negotiated from the market. So it will be a negotiation between the radio stations and the rights holders that will eventually lead to agreeing to some sort of set of fees. So this is an interesting interesting bill. I have my doubts that it's going to get approved, but as a hypothetical, Scott, what do you think about this massive change in the way that master owners are compensated from radio stations in the States?
Yeah, I totally support the notion of this bill. The timing is just a half a century too late. We're not in an era where radio and is on the rise. It's all being replaced with digital.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say it's pointless because, you know, it's a long, slow ride on its way down, but it's like imposing something on, ringtones, They were great, but missed the moment, now if you can imagine in America when you have somewhere around 30 million subscribers to SiriusXM radio, well, the master owners are already compensated for those performances. So
Yeah. We're
moving more in that direction and less in the direction of radio. But with that said, it doesn't mean it should be ignored. Of course, the master owner should get compensated, and the artist and everyone that's creating for that. They shouldn't just get a free pass.
Yeah, Chris, on your front, radio has been the original freeloader as far as music is concerned. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a few decades too late, but at the same time, I'm somewhat bullish on the continued influence of radio in terms of music discovery. There have certainly been studies that have shown that it remains to be a pretty sticky format when it comes to fans finding out about artists. And when I'm home in New York and I'm online all the time, I can certainly understand the mentality that everything's digital, right? Like, digital is what's relevant, everything else is irrelevant. But at the same time, I'm from the Midwest. I'm from Wisconsin, and I go back to Wisconsin and Minnesota during the summer. And when I'm there, I have a car. I'm using a car and I'm driving around. And it's a nice reminder for me that most people who are commuting every day, who are driving, they're still using radio, and they still do depend on it to find out about artists. So, I think it's going to continue to be relevant. I think this is a great step forward, but certainly I'm excited about the prospect of taking all of the kind of discontent that's out there in regards to internet radio, in regards to payments and Pandora, and being artists, all of a sudden they have something to get behind and to rally around. And who knows? Maybe this is the right time, and with some participation from a broad artistic community, this could resolve a lot of the debates that we've been having, at least in regards to legitimate services. The illegitimate service problem is still out there, and it's clearly work to be done to go after piracy. But I'm guardedly optimistic about it.
Yeah, I mean, my key question is whether this is something that should be government mandated through a piece of legislation like this one. Because on the other hand, we've seen the private sector moving into this arena with the deal that was made between Warner Music and Clear Channel just about 10 days ago, whereby Warner Music will start receiving performance royalties from music that Clear Channel plays on its terrestrial radio networks in exchange for Clear Channel being able to negotiate a lower licensing fee for the use of Warner's tracks in a digital domain for something like iHeartRadio, for example. So I'm wondering whether this is an attempt to regulate a market that otherwise would strongly favor the larger players in the industry, like the Warners and the Universals and the Sonys of this world, to be able to negotiate these performance royalties from terrestrial radios in exchange for something else, whilst all the other independent players would be left out of that particular pot of money. Scott, is that something that maybe would concern you, because coming from an independent perspective?
Well, I don't think the independents would be left out of those negotiations, right, without speaking specifically about what our negotiations have been.
Sure.
But I also do believe it should be a government mandated license. Because radio is licensed. It is how it should be done. They're granted special licenses from the government to broadcast, and they have to follow very certain rules about it. And that's one of the reasons. Am I allowed to talk about why radio isn't going to be around for much longer? Can I have a rebuttal against Chris? In a healthy way.
Of course, yeah.
And by the way, I thought you were born a hipster. but you moved to Brooklyn.
Well, I don't know. That's subject for a whole other show.
All right, that'll be part two. No, I mean, listen, radio. Where do I start? I mean, maybe I'll start with teenagers or even younger. Do you really think they're going to their parents and going, you know what? Fuck that iPad. Please buy me a radio. Do you think any kid is getting those devices? Or do you think a kid, you can explain to them that while you're listening to this song, if you don't like it, you just have to keep waiting because maybe you'll like the one after that. And if you don't like that one, don't worry, just keep waiting. Maybe you'll like the one after that. And then there'll be a 6 or 9 minute advert break where you have to listen to that. I mean, the idea of radio is kind of over. I think curation of music and delivering it to people, absolutely, you need that. I think that when you also get into things like the automobile, like Chris brought up, I mean, within the next 4 years, 80% of all the automobiles sold in North America and Western Europe will be connected cars. And now, given the choice of listening to a very tightly programmed radio station with advertising or accessing your Spotify, RDO, Deezer account, your own personal collection, or anything else, I think is going to greatly impact radio and take away a significant market share. I think the infrastructure of radio and having those towers and make some unsustainable in the future. And I think overall the government that grants those licenses for radio broadcasts and saying to us that no, we can't get faster mobile 4G networks, we can't get faster broadband because we've used up that spectrum so somebody can play 8 songs in an hour. It seems crazy to me.
I mean, if I were in your position and I was having to, you know, evaluate the environment and make bets on where is growth going to be in the future, right? I don't think I would be putting all of my cards into radio. So, you know, I absolutely see where you're coming from there. But what I'm saying isn't necessarily that radio is going to be, you know, this growth industry or the, you know, the one dominant format. What I'm saying is it's going to remain relevant. And this is still a huge billion-dollar industry out there where radio stations are getting a tremendous amount of revenue from advertising. Now, is that going to completely disappear in the next 5 years or 10 years or 15 years? Maybe. But as of right now, it's still relevant. And as of right now, you know, it's not about teenagers asking their parents to get a radio. Of course, nobody's doing that. It's a question of, you know, right now people still are using terrestrial radio in their automobiles. So for the time being, until that transition happens, whether it's, you know, speaking about digitization and these, these innovations and evolutions, there are shitloads of predictions that have been made over the years. Most of them have been wrong. So I'm reluctant to make assumptions about, you know, huge shifts that are going to happen in the next 5 years. We'll see. Maybe it's true. People will completely convert to satellite. But for now, I would just say it's still relevant.
Yeah. No, I see it as kind of like the collapse of the CD. That once digital's on the landscape, then you know, it was pretty obvious in the 90s what was coming. Even though we still have CD stores and there's still the number one, you know, format in many
still
ways.
Still driving the industry.
However, it's we're just riding it down to the bottom. We see where it's going. It's not going to be the future. So it's just about picking a date. You know, when does radio, you know, drop? Certainly in terms of ad revenue, you know, advertisers are less inclined to give a radio station money. As a matter of fact, that's been flat for a very long time.
Yeah.
Because they just have some random demographic information. They don't even know how many people are listening or who they are. Versus when you're in a digital environment, you know exactly who's listening, not a demographic, not a psychographic, but exactly who's listening, how much, what else are they doing, what are they like, just so much more powerful. And the money is just pouring into that and away from a terrestrial. So I guess what I'm saying is all of these things, you know, it's kind of, you know, chip away, you know, at radio. It's not one big thing. It's a lot of little things. And if you lose, you know, 5 or 10% of your business this year, 5 or 10 the next year, then it just collapses at some point, falls over.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just... we don't really know what's going to happen, you know, and you don't know what consumers are going to choose. And consumers don't always choose efficiency. And they don't always want to be in control of the music they're listening to either. You know, I don't think it's a sure thing that streaming services and the economics of streaming services are going to play out, you know, in a hugely profitable manner. And it strikes me that most of the people who are running these services are more inclined to get a IPO and to cash out. You know, I don't know if the folks who are working for these companies are really in it for the next 20 years. So, you know, we'll see. You know, not some people like to be served. And
I'm with you. I absolutely believe that there is so much stuff out there that most people have no interest in. They want things curated and brought to them.
Right.
I'm just saying radio is not going to be that medium.
Traditional radio, yeah, exactly.
Traditional radio.
And Scott, you're talking about a generational shift and a generational shift of one that is going to take, you know, 10 to 20 years to take place. So,
yep.
Of course, we're not talking about immediacies here, but I do see, like, you know, if you look at the 20 years down the line, even if there are broadcasts that are similar to radio that involve, I mean, I feel personally that one of the things that are left out from the new services that are out there is the lack of talk integration. So, for example, people love radio because there is that interaction with the DJ. There is the opportunity to get weather updates, news updates that are local to you. And so that element of it still has to be cracked by any of the music services out there. There's no integration at the moment with talk almost anywhere apart from Slacker. And I've seen this new deal with between iHeartRadio and Spreaker, which is quite interesting. So I feel like that's going to be like a very interesting place as well for things to evolve into.
Yeah. And I think the fact that CDs haven't collapsed more is an example of you know, the unpredictability of consumer choice and what they really want. You know, even in an atmosphere where you can go online and download any album illegally for free, people are still buying CDs, and you know, not nearly as many as they used to, but they're still buying them. It's still a $1 billion market. So, I mean, multi-billion-dollar market. So it's you know, I guess my only point is that there is a mysterious quality to consumer choice, and no doubt we're entering a new future of expanded choice and diversity. But also, you know, the subject of my book is sort of about how below all of these legitimate services is a giant black market, which is destabilizing these services, and you know. What sort of the idea that makes me wonder is, let's say in a perfect world, you know, piracy isn't done away with, but it's more effectively marginalized, and a consumer all of a sudden has to say, okay, well, I'm not going to get it for free as easily as I used to. Do I use the streaming service? Do I pay a subscription for that? Or if I'm going to be paying money for a digital album, would I rather just get something physical? You know, I think those. It's hard to predict those choices, and I wonder what they would be if there were better copyright enforcement.
That's interesting. And I wanted to, you know, we talked about curation for a second there, and I just wanted to jump on and talk about the news on Sounddrop, which is a startup that started its life as a Spotify app and has gathered enough momentum over the last couple of years to close first $3 million round last year, and this week it announced a second round of $3.4 million, which was led by the investor North Zone, which is also Spotify's lead investor. So if you haven't tried Sounddrop out before. So it's a way to make listening more social. Essentially, anybody can create a virtual room where people can gather to listen to a specific type of music together, essentially like a playlist, and people can contribute to this playlist as well. And the company's aim is now to become cross-platform, so moving away from Spotify as being, you know, the main thing that people identify SoundDrop with, and you know, becoming ubiquitous, essentially. So that's what this new round of funding is. The thing is that this brings the funding of SoundDrop to 6.4 million within, you know, the space of 15, 16 months. And I've seen loads of different reactions on Twitter over this. So do you think it's madness that a service like this is getting so much attention and so much funding? Or do you think there's something, do you think they're right on the money? Chris, do you feel like this is a startup with legs?
I don't know. I'm highly skeptical. I guess, in full honesty, I'm very skeptical of all of these startups, given recent history, and Turntable FM, I think, being a great example of, you know, a new service comes along, it's providing the music in a slightly different manner with a social component, and, you know, there's a nice round of investment, and people get excited and wonder, oh, maybe this is the next big thing. You know, I think Scott's might be better suited to really talk about it, but in general, I guess I sort of wait and see what pans out, because there have been so many companies that have come and gone over just the past 5 years that, I'm just generally skeptical.
Yeah. And Scott, this company is also placing a lot of emphasis for its sort of evolution on artists actually joining in and creating rooms and record labels getting involved. And so have you got any direct experience with SoundDrop? And do you feel like this is something that is here to stay, or just another startup like Chris said?
Yeah, we've actually done a number of these SoundDrop rooms with artists. You know, it's just another way to engage with audiences, and is this the company that's going to win or not, or the service that wins or not? I don't know that. That if I could predict that, then my
BBC,
life would look
yeah.
I would be running the world. But
you'd have golden headphones on, right?
Right. Yeah. But, yeah, instead of whatever these cheap things are. But with that said, I don't know which company and which exact service, but I do know that these types of behaviors are what people are going to be using more. You know, they like more social aspects. They like sharing. They like engaging with artists. It just is how it is. Which one wins, I don't know. Which platform, I don't know. From an investor standpoint, you take a shot because there's not a whole lot of competition around it, and you get in and you kind of become the one. You know, it's a reasonable investment strategy. You know, there's one Twitter, there's one Facebook, there's one YouTube. If this is the one place where people use this behavior and it becomes the ingrained one, then it's going to look pretty smart.
Do you guys think it's more likely that, you know, I was just going to make that same point, Scott, about how the internet economy seems to drive everything. It's almost anti-competitive. Like there emerges this one major player that sort of controls the entire market for a particular service. So do you think it's more likely that Spotify would, or something like Spotify, if another service emerges like Deezer, just ends up, you know, scooping up what they're trying to do?
Yeah, I do. What's interesting is, it does seem like this is what happens, but what's interesting is the pace at which it's happening seems to accelerate. You know, from Microsoft's ultimate dominance to its slow change to, you know, MySpace, big one day, and then it seemed like overnight over, you know, and even shorter, Turntable, like everyone's on it, and then it's over. And it's just, wow, it's going incredibly fast. So even if somebody does dominate, by the time you figured out they dominated, everyone's off to the next thing.
Right.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is that, in a way, I could see SoundDrop as being touted as a feature rather than a company. I heard a lot of startups in the last few years that when you hear the pitch, it sounds more like a feature than an actual business or in its own rights. But the interesting thing here is that if they manage to go cross-platform, then it does become a business in its own rights because it manages to bring together people that otherwise would be insulated in their own island of streaming service. So that, I think that that's really an interesting value that the company can bring into the equation for this service. Moving on to another interesting type of curated service that we haven't actually seen anything of, but we can't seem to go a week without talking about. We're going to have a quick look at Beats' latest news, and Beats, of course, linked to their upcoming streaming service, Daisy. And this week, we reported that only a few days after announcing a buyback of the 24% share of the company owned by electronics giant HTC, which was worth $265 million, Beats has found a brand new investor in the private investment firm Carlyle Group. So the group invested $500 million in the company in exchange for a minority stake, although given the price of the HTC buyback, I would imagine that's sort of at least a 40% stake, otherwise it wouldn't make much sense. But no specifics have been given out to the public. Carlyle Group is a very powerful investment group. They have lots of pies and could provide Beats with interesting connections on the hardware front and could also perhaps help out Daisy on this front and help them maximize the exposure of the service when it does come out. This makes a lot of sense, of course, for Beats hardware side because it's a very valuable company and the turnover is huge. On the Daisy front, do you feel like an investment of this kind from a big company that has lots of hardware connections as well could bolster the fortunes of Daisy and its debut when it comes out? Scott, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I think it ticks a number of boxes in making the deal interesting. Certainly, bundling the content, you know, the music content in this case, with the hardware is a clever play. I mean, iTunes, that's what they did. You know, that's how they built themselves, putting an iPod with a music service. Beats is out there and saying, yeah, when you get the headphones, guess what? It comes with all the music in the world. And as new things are released, it just comes with it. Makes sense. You know, in the UK, if you buy a new iPhone, it comes hard bundled with either your choice of Sky Sports or Spotify. You don't pay extra. It just comes with it. And so I think there's a lot of logic in that, particularly once you put a service in there, a music service, then you know who your end customer is. And for most hardware companies, the problem is if you don't know who your end customer is, then you can be disintermediated very quickly. You know, think Nokia and stuff like that, and why companies like Amazon or Apple have been so successful is because they have content, but they also have customer details. They know who they are. This could be a really powerful thing if done right. I mean, the concept, you see, whether it succeeds or not, I don't know. I don't know what the service is going to be. But if done right, it becomes pretty massive.
Chris, yeah, and I think it's a huge advantage. And, you know, just walking around the streets, you see an awful lot of Beats headphones, and young people especially, you know, seem to love them. So, what we're talking about, that this really quick turnover in digital services, that may, once Daisy actually comes out, that may sort of come into play with Spotify and people becoming a little tired of Spotify and wanting to check out something new. And yeah, if they're able to provide a subscription with a purchase of headphones, and that may expand to other hardware options in the future, that seems to me a huge advantage. And you know, I'd like to see a more competitive environment in subscription services so that artists, would have more choice in which ones to partner with. And hopefully, I'm sort of a one trick pony. I talk about artists' rights and hopefully getting them paid more in the future. So I'm very, interested to see that kind of process play out. And yeah, I'm hopeful that Daisy can be that service that maybe can become more associated with paying artists and make that part of their marketing.
And you know, just going back again, I can't speak to exactly what their future plans are, but if you could think about how people buy mobile phones when they go in to the store, it's like, well, if you just get this 2-year contract and you give me X a year, then we'll give you this phone, or we'll give you this phone for, you know, an incredible discount. Imagine if Beats Headphones said, you get free headphones for, you know, $10 a month.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to sign a 2-year contract.
Yeah.
I mean, how powerful could that be?
Yeah.
And
well,
if they haven't thought of that, they should give me a ring and I'll walk them through the strategy.
Yeah. You know, I think that would be powerful. I just, you know, the one hedge I have for all this stuff is until, I mean, when I talk to people who are in their early 20s and ask them, I don't tell them what book I wrote, you know, but I ask them, where do you get your music from? Do you stream it? Do you get it from iTunes? Do you download it for free? Without exception, they download it for free from Pirate Bay. So until that behavior changes, the potential for any of these subscription services or the advantage that would be seen in, oh, I only have to pay $10 for the subscription fee and I get something extra out of it. You know, if you as a consumer are thinking, well, why would I pay $10 for a subscription fee when I can get it all for free otherwise? Yeah. Just the potential is going to be less than what it would be otherwise. So,
yeah.
Has anyone ever questioned who you're hanging out with, Chris? All these pirates and, you know, what crowd are you hanging with?
You have to read my book. That's where I'm from.
It's a rough story, that, isn't it?
I've corrected myself, and now I'm here to, you know, spread the gospel.
And in the second half of the show, we're going to talk about Spotify's Spotlight feature, Songs as partnership with Foursquare, the YouTube Music Awards, and much more. But first, a short information piece with DMT's sponsors, Sheridan's. I'm here with Tahir Bashir, and we continue our series of segments on digital service providers. Hi, Tahir, and thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So today we're going to talk about the relationship between DSPs and their perspective, you know, content providers and rights holders. So how important is it to actually understand who the right person to talk to is within an organization, and what's the best way to do that for a startup that wants to make a deal with, say, Warner or Universal?
It's crucially important. I mean, I remember when I acted for one of the startups that we ended up selling, so it wasn't a startup by the time we sold it, that it took us a year when we first did it to find the right person within the label, and once we'd found them, things started moving much quicker. So ultimately, you need to be dealing with the right people. What is the best way to do that? Obviously, do your research, ask around, use lawyers that have dealt with them, because they have a hotline into them, and they know who basically makes the decisions and who to deal with. But if you're not talking to the right person, you're banging your head against a brick wall.
Absolutely. And there's a bit of a cultural difference, actually, between the US and the UK. I've dealt with companies on both sides of the Atlantic. And so what's the best way to, because I know in the States it's very much a personable approach, and, you know, you actually end up, you know, becoming friends with some of these people and go for dinner with them or having a barbecue. Yeah. In the UK, it's a little bit more complex because the relationships don't build quite as quickly. So what's the recommendation to find the right person within an organization and actually build a really great relationship so that they can advocate for your company within their own?
Yeah, I mean, that is actually the key, is if you can find people that effectively become champions of your service from within, so they really like your service, so that when they're in their decision-making role, you know, they advocate it. That's the key. That's the key outside of digital service providers anyway. How do you do that? You have, you know, ultimately it comes down to time. You need to try and spend time with people. So, do the barbecues here, obviously. If you can do that, then that's great. But ultimately, the way it works, I guess, is going to events, meeting people, following up, going for coffees, going for lunches. But just getting to know someone and understanding their culture and what's important to them, and being able to show them that your solution deals with those issues.
Yeah. And finally, looking at how you can help yourself getting to these people. How important is it to hire the right people within your own organization as a startup in order to ensure that perhaps you hire somebody that already has some relationships built up? And why do you find those people?
Yeah. It's not just startups we're talking about here. I mean, ultimately, you know, there's different levels of service provider. You start up, and then actually in the music industry with digital service providers, you need to scale up relatively quickly because time ticks away. You've got short-term deals, so you need to make sure you're using those rights. So finding the right type of people is crucial. First of all, they need to have the skill set to deal with understanding at the business development level the rights that we're talking about. So quite often what happens is the digital service provider will actually look at the rights owners themselves and look at people within those organizations and hire them.
Yeah.
I mean, if you almost look at the PRS, half of them go on to private DSPs. Similarly, at labels, they kind of switch sides. I can name many of the digital service providers, the number of people that have come from labels or collection societies or publishers. So, it's a very common practice to hire people that have done it before.
Awesome. Thank you very much. And until the next segment, thank you. And Christy, we're talking about Spotify, and Spotify this week launched a new feature called Spotlight with the artists Haim and Lordi. Lord or Lordi? Lordi?
I say Lord, but I don't know.
I think it's pronounced Lord.
Okay, Lord. Great. Awesome. Yeah. I started with that, and then I overthought it. This new feature, Spotlight, aims to collate and display in a more all-rounded way the material that the streaming platform has gathered on an artist over time. So Spotify is trying to do more editorial. So they do interviews with artists. They get them to curate playlists. They record live sessions as well. And so this is a place where they can aggregate all of this content hopefully serve the artists better and give them more exposure on the platform. So in an interview with Music Allies, Spotify's Will Hope maintained that artists will be chosen on the basis of what's bubbling up on the platform. So hopefully, it won't be just a major label playground. Spotify is live now on the browser-based version of the service. It's not yet on the Mac version, at least as of this morning. So it seems like a very interesting new play, and it certainly goes to answer some of the calls for Spotify to do more for artists. But because it's editorial-based, there's a very limited amount of bandwidth that Spotify is going to be able to devote to providing this for a certain number of artists. So it still doesn't answer the question of how it deals with giving exposure to independents. What do you think about this new service, Chris? You're also very interested in getting more money to artists and finding ways to do that. So do you feel like this is going in the right direction for Spotify?
I mean, it's positive. I certainly don't have any complaints about it. You could, if you want to view it from the most cynical lens, possible, then it's, you could say they're just trying, it's a PR move in some way, but I'm not that cynical. I think it's still a net positive for artists. I don't think Spotify, they've become a very easy company to attack because they are legitimate.
Yeah.
And artists do have some agency, or at least some artists have agency to take their music down. But really, the bad guys are the websites that are making money off of free music, or the huge tech companies that portray any attempt to, give artists basic fairness as censorship.
Yeah,
those are the bad guys, as far as I'm concerned. But there's still this persistent culture of fear among artists and among labels in stating the obvious, which is that there is this huge black market and artists are getting screwed. And, that is the foundational problem as far as I see it. And if you can plug that, in theory, then artists and labels will be in a much better negotiating position with services like Spotify. But right now, Spotify can just say, at least we're paying you something. It may not be much, but it's something. And as an artist, what do you say to that? So
I'd say Spotify pays out, and most of these services pays out about 70%.
That's right. Yeah.
To the rights holders, so they're actually paying the lion's share of the money coming in out to rights holders. How that's divided is amongst the rights holders and what their arrangements are.
They're paying 70%, but they're paying 70% of really paltry revenues that aren't coming from, for the most part, paid subscriptions. They're coming from free services that are off getting money from advertising revenues.
See, I would disagree. I think this year they're going to pay out over $500 million U.S. dollars, $500 million, which is 70% of the money that comes in. And if they're doing, they have an amazing conversion rate of around 20%. Which is a spectacularly high conversion rate.
Yeah.
I'm glad that they're paying that money out, and I'm sure it's going to inch up more and more and more as the years, or explode, you know, as the years go on. But okay, $500 million versus, and there's just a number I saw, that $4.6 billion invested in artists via A&R, etc., by major labels in the past year alone. So if you're looking at the environment that's out there, those payouts, even though for a huge artist, you know, you can make good money because of the volume that you're getting, for the most part, you know, they're not even playing on the same field. In terms of sales, you know, or revenues from iTunes.
I would disagree, and it depends on what territory you're in terms of how much, what percentage of the pie that is. If you're in Sweden, it's your biggest revenue source, ahead of CDs and ahead of downloads.
Or the Netherlands, right? Netherlands.
Yeah, it really depends where you are, and that also depends on when the service was launched, because it takes some time to penetrate into a market. So we see the first markets where it was launched, you know, then the second wave, then the third wave, and the fourth wave. So it takes some years to be significant. But even if you just look at something in the States, again, I mentioned earlier, Sirius XM radio, you have 30 million people paying between $10 and $15 a month for radio. So the concept of already paying this monthly subscription fee exists. And the reason exists is also kind of that bundling. They're paying it because when they're buying a new car and they say your monthly payment is going to be, you know, $217 a month, but you know what, for $227, we'll give you this. And they're like, sure, just add it in there. And so how quickly could that same money be pushed over to these, which again doesn't help the market because it's just shifting from one to another. But yeah. But you could begin to see how these subscription services can penetrate very quickly and scale very quickly when they're bundled offers.
Yeah, and I hope they do. I guess what I'm interested in seeing the Spotify paid subscription rate, which is what, you know, 5 million, 6 million now.
Yeah, 6 million.
It's getting up into that 20+ million scale. I think that's when we'll know. Okay. You know, this is going to work out for everybody, and Spotify can be profitable and artists can get paid. And
I agree. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. So I was just going to ask you, just going back to the story, like, what is your take on Spotlight? Do you feel like this is something that you would welcome as somebody that is trying to push artists on a platform like Spotify, or is it too restrictive in terms of the breadth of artists that could be featured on here?
No, I think anytime you're featuring artists, it's a good thing. When iTunes first launched, they didn't really have a big plan of how they were going to populate all of their we're going to put some stuff up on the main page. You're like, okay, what about the jazz page, the blues page, the reggae page? Oh crap, you know, there's a lot of shit that needs to be programmed and how it's going to be different in different countries because it all is different. So yeah, Spotify does their first few of them, but before you know it, it's like if you listen to indie rock, then there's going to be a whole bunch of spotlights around those, and if you're into hip hop, there's something different. The potential is there to just keep growing because it's delivering, you know, significant value for the end user.
Yeah,
that's why it happens. If the end user feels this is valuable and they engage with it, then they'll keep doing it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in Freeloading, one of the people I interview, Adam Farrell from Beggars Group, and he sort of makes this point that there is this, if you just have this pure streaming service that's on demand, it's very easy for a customer to become overwhelmed. So, you know, maybe part of that solution or successful model for these streaming services over the long term is identifying what kind of curation or spotlighting our fans really going to appreciate and be drawn to.
Yeah. it's classic, you know, paradox of choice. You know, consumers demand an abundance of choice, but then faced with this, they freeze, or they go back to the same old patterns where you go, "Hey, you can listen to anything you want," and they're like, "Really?" You know, because I'll invite people over to my place, and you know, that have never actually tried Spotify, and you sit them down in front of a computer and say, okay, type in any band name you want. And they just don't know. They just can't think. Well, what do you like? I like everything. And, you know, and you need these kind of little cues to help people start down that path of discovery.
Yeah, sure. And of course, there's also the elements, you know, in a social situation like that, when you're trying to find an artist that you want to play, you're thinking, you've got a thousand things going through your head, like, is this appropriate for the situation we're at? Is this going to keep playing in the background? Does this work with the situation? So it's definitely, I just got an email from Mark Mulligan. His latest post is called The Tyranny of Choice, which is, I think, an interesting title for it. And it makes a lot of sense. Talking about a service that is based in New York, actually, two services that are based in New York, there was a very interesting partnership announced this week through Billboard. Glenn Peoples reported this week on SongZell's partnership with Foursquare, both New York-based companies. And this partnership will allow SongZell's users to receive special badges and curated playlists when they check into select venues. So this will be an extra perk for users that use SongZell and use Foursquare at the same time. And there will be also a giveaway for people that reach the second level badge on this particular offer, which will get them 500, up to 500 6 months memberships of SongZell Club, which is the ad-free version of SongZell. So this partnership is very New York heavy for now. So Chris, you can probably try it out because most of the venues are in New York. There are a bunch of venues in other cities as well, but of course the plan is to expand this. And I love the idea because there hasn't been much interaction between location-based services and streaming companies, and how the two can interact and provide a better value for the consumers. So I like this approach. Of course, it's a very niche subsection of people that would use both SongZell and Foursquare. So that's, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in the mainstream. But I like it. Chris, are you going to use this in New York?
Probably not, but but I do like the idea. I think it is a sort of a new twist. And SongZell, I believe they're in Long Island City in Queens, which is just across the Superfund site called Newtown Creek that I live next to. So, but I've used SongZell a little bit, and in terms of curation, I actually really like the interface, and thought, you know, at least I like the songs that they were playing when I was using it. So I really do like this idea of linking those physical venues and the physical realm, the analog world, to the convenience and the choice of the digital world. It seems like a winning strategy. Now we'll see how it works out. But it seems like a smart play to me for SongZell to be going in that direction.
Definitely. And it seems like it would also open up the opportunity for venues, if they are able to change the playlists on the fly, to update the playlists to reflect the lineups that they have coming up as well, which is, it could be quite an interesting way for people to discover what bands are playing in their local area and what's happening
around
there.
And a more sticky way of discovering this music, because you're not just, you know, hearing 10 songs from artists that you may or may not remember the names of. You actually have a memory of seeing these artists, and memories of whatever was going on that night when you go to the show. And, I think all of those elements are really what makes for an enjoyable experience as a music fan.
Yeah. Scott, can you see this working in London, if and when SongZell will launch here?
Yes. It's funny because I think of all of these things as really interesting, but still kind of just a bridge to the future. You know, it's just, it's not the end. It's one more step to getting where we need to be. It's still way too much work from the user. You know, if we have to spend, you know, the rest of my life kind of buried like this into my phone, I mean, this is not the future I see. So fine, we still have to go in, check in, and do this and pick that. Yeah, it's fine, but ultimately, I look at a world where technology starts to work for us rather than us working for it, and I see us investing a lot of time working for the technology right now. Yep. You know,
so. Could you talk more about that vision that you, I'm just curious what, you know,
It's more of a global thought. You know, if you can imagine, you know, web 1.0 was merely taking the offline world and putting it online. You know, it could be, you know, Amazon books, you know, you could buy it in a shop, but now you can just buy it online. And you can search for it. A web 2.0 world where there's all this interaction, which is, you know, a Facebook world, and it's an Expedia, you know, a Web 3.0 is when, you know, imagine, all right, so I just used Expedia. So right now, if I have to go to fly to Barcelona, and I put in my schedule that I have a trip coming up, well, I still have to book my flight, my hotel, my airport transportation, everything. In a 3.0 world, it just recognizes that I have a trip coming up. So it'll reserve a flight for me on my favorite airline with my frequent flyer number, which hotel I prefer, get me an upgrade, and just sort it out, and then just bring it back to me and say, is this cool with you, yes or no? You know, and so what does that mean for music consumption, including with the Foursquare and location based? You know, it's understanding who I am, who I'm with, what I like, what I might like, and instead of having me have to hunt and search and, you know, just deliver me stuff. You bring it to me. If I don't like it, I can push it away, pass it on, but stop making me do so much work in this world. We have this technology that's supposed to work for us, and right now it isn't. That's only because we're trying to figure all this out, you know, what people want, what they actually do. And so that is the world I see, with whether it's for any kind of information, no distinction between entertainment or science, just bring me the stuff that I might want. And the stuff even that I don't know that I might want. What are things that are just going to delight me that I didn't even realize I would want?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, it's just interesting to think about what is Web 3.0 and what is that going to mean? Did you guys see the Popular Science? There was a Popular Science magazine just got rid of comments on their articles online, and they had a post with basically all the science of why comment sections actually confuse people, and scientifically they go through why they're not good if you're dealing with, you know, portraying facts, because people get in arguments, and you know, if they see really negative comments out there, even if the article is totally legit, readers are more likely to come away thinking, oh well, I don't really trust this because I see that there's disagreement about it. So but it just strikes me as very interesting, you know, because for so long Web 2.0 was like more participation, more comments, crowdfunded, user-based, you know?
Right.
Here comes everybody. But then, I don't know, it just seems like there's this moderation that's going on, and people are starting to question things a little bit.
I think so. You know, you could think of things like fashion and art, where they don't really ask your opinion. You know, somebody, you know, Anna Wintour says, this is fashionable and you should wear this. I didn't ask you what you think of it. I'm telling you, this is what's in this season. Full stop. You know, and the art world says, no, this is art. I didn't ask whether you like it or not. We're telling you, this is art. This is good. This goes in the gallery. I didn't need a comment section. So in a way, we are moving to a world where, yeah, there's experts, including people that curate music, whether it's a human, an algorithm, a social algorithm, some combination. Yeah, you do it. and I won't comment. And my comment is either I paid attention to it or I ignored it.
Yeah.
That's how I know you got it right.
Right.
Absolutely. And moving on to the last story of today, I want to talk about YouTube. YouTube announced the YouTube Music Awards this week, which will take place on the 3rd of November. The event, which is of course organized by YouTube to capitalize on the hold that it has on the music space at the moment, you know, we're all talking about it as the biggest music service in the world right now, will feature performances by Lady Gaga, Arcade Fire, and Eminem, amongst others. Of course, YouTube will also bring in some of its YouTube stars that it created through the service, and it plans to be international and relevant by broadcasting from a number of cities, including London, Moscow, Seoul, Rio, and the whole thing will culminate in New York City. So this is a very interesting play from YouTube. By all measures, you know, they want to become the MTV of this generation. They already are, to be honest. They just want to consolidate their position with these awards. And on the other side, I think it's super interesting, so let me know your thoughts on that. And on the other side, I had this sort of interesting side theory, which was to do with the rumored so far offline mode that YouTube is going to implement at some point in the future. The fact that this offline mode is in the works, plus these music awards, I was wondering whether you think there's anything to these two things as to something that might point in the direction of an actual YouTube music service launching anytime soon, as it was rumored when the Google Play musical access thing launched, where everybody was talking about how Google was planning to launch two services, one with Google Play and one with YouTube. I don't know, what are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, first, I'm surprised it took them so long.
exactly.
In one way, I don't think anyone was surprised. It was like, oh, really?
Fair enough, yeah.
you haven't done this before? Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, it seemed completely natural, but it brings really home a few things that they own video and people are going to watch. Two is, if they're putting on their own show, now YouTube is owning content and creating content versus showing the MTV Music Awards and then, you know, showing it online or showing it on YouTube. Now it's their content. They own it.
Yeah.
That could mean lots of things going forward for them in the space.
Absolutely. Chris?
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how much they actually invest in it, what the costs are like. I think that'll maybe be a signal to where they're going in the future and whether this is an experiment or, I mean, I agree with Scott, you know, why hasn't this happened before, even at some kind of a doing it on the cheap level? It seems like they could have done this very easily. Maybe they're worried about the bandwidth of making, you know, of going in this direction and having to shoulder more costs. I don't know. It's funny how people still love awards shows. You know, they seem to be getting more popular. I love how when the Grammys come on, like the last 2 years, the same thing has happened. I think it was both years where, you know, the Grammys air, you read Gawker, you read websites, and they're like, oh, this is the worst Grammys ever. This was so terrible. Everybody's on Twitter complaining about the Grammys. And then the next day you find out that the ratings are up. You know, the ratings went up for the most they have in 10 years or something. So, or then, you know, the VMAs. It's just, you know, another one of those interesting things to note that as much as things are changing in so many different ways, there are these very traditional sort of relics of the entertainment past that maybe people find comfort in, or I'm not sure what it is, but you know, the awards show is remaining relevant.
It must hit something very primal in our brains. Like, you know, we're cavemen, you know, giving people awards for, you know,
yeah,
oh,
right.
You really clubbed that animal really good, you know?
Well, I think it does go back to curation, the stuff we've been talking about before, because, you know, where our, this new world was supposed to be the long tail, right? Which, you know, not happening, but, you know, where you have all these niches and they're sort of self-sustaining, and you have all this diversity and choice. But what are awards shows really? But taking all of these different cultural elements that are out there and bringing them together for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And people getting to see it all and to participate and to talk to one another about it.
Well, I think that's part of it. I think we also like things in common. We all need to have something to bind us together. And sometimes, yeah, it's gangman style because, all right, at least we all saw it once, you know, and so now we can talk about it. And so it doesn't matter on one level whether you like Miley Cyrus or not. We all just said, all right, well, I better check out Wrecking Ball because this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It, and
yeah.
I only have to invest 3.5 minutes of my time. So,
yeah.
You know. Yeah, why not?
I think it does become very tribal on that level, you know. Just
it's gonna be interesting for me to see. Yeah, it's gonna be interesting to see if they actually manage to tap into local talents as well, because they're talking about cities from all over the world. It would be a shame if they just put Lady Gaga in Seoul, Arcade Fire in Rio, and somebody else in Moscow. That is all of the same sort of Anglo-American. Take, you know, I would love to see like a Korean artist or a Russian artist actually come up and do their bit. So
or an Italian artist.
Yes,
Let's get Negro Morrow on.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so that's all good. And the last thing I want to mention is that Vivo launched in Germany this week, just in passing. Interesting news because Vivo is going it alone in Germany and they won't have YouTube support because, of course, most videos on YouTube are not available to the German market. So it's going to be interesting how they plan on marketing themselves and making themselves known to the German audience. And also the other thing is that the iTunes Festival drew to a close with Katy Perry's gig on Monday. And so interesting to see Apple putting so much emphasis on this event. They even featured it in the very first bit of the iPhone announcement earlier, actually in September, so last month. So very interesting to see how much commitment Apple still seems to have in the music space. Maybe for lack of exciting things happening on the hardware front so far.
They're still selling pretty well, though.
Oh, yeah, it's still selling very well, so exactly. I'm a fanboy, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, those are the last two things that I wanted to mention. And yeah, I think I skipped a few stories because there's just so much to talk about today. But it was absolutely a pleasure having you on, guys. And thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And thanks so much for listening. DMT is available on a variety of platforms, as I mentioned. You can email on contact at digitalmusictrends.com or tweet on at digimusictrends. Have a great week and until next time. And that's all for this week. I really hope you enjoyed the show. Check out digitalmusictrends.com and sign up to the weekly newsletter.